Shel Shmuel Pakim, called the first parak. I'm going to discuss a sort of schematic description of the various components of human soul. It's primarily four. One of the was Chilek Hazan, the vegetative soul of a person, a physical being, that which the very sensory part, the sensory soul, five senses, etc., passive imagination, the element of desire, stirs and moves a person, and the intellectual part. A lot of this time goes on in the second chapter, discuss what is the focus of obedience, rebelliousness, part of a person, with regard to values, with regard to norms, of course, particularly with regard to Moshe, with the word of Halacha, and to which part, to which aspect of the human soul they relate. Such what Ram says is that these are to be found, these to relate primarily to the part which feels, the feeling part, the sensory part of a person, and the element, the motive element, that which moves him, which is close to the word of desire, the element of will, that we would think, in terms of which we would think. He then phases out this connection, parts which he says to be involuntary, the vegetative part of a person, and the element of imagination. Ram says in this connection is that not that these are not areas which are to which the element of the normative element is relevant, but it's as for the human soul, which there's no control and no intelligent ability to relate, and consequently you can't speak of them in terms of rebelliousness or obedience. These are involuntary. Purushottam brings these two elements of involuntary, and the fact they are operative even a person is sleeping, which is not true of the other capacities. A person doesn't think in his sleep, he doesn't initiate in his sleep, but the physical entity, the human being, that of course functions. I find it difficult to understand as to whether this is such a proof or not. If you're dealing with the whole of that world as a single entity, a single unit, that's safe to function even a person involuntarily when a person is sleeping, then apparently that's an area to which will and obedience can be related that I can understand. But why must we relate it, treat it all as being one collective unit? May it well be that in this world of with physical activity, that there's certain elements which are indeed involuntary, and others which are very much voluntary. Take the area which Tom speaks of over here, the capacity of imagination. I'll certainly speak of the possibility that a person may imagine certain things which in his sleep, which may or may not be problematic. But even assuming that whatever person dreams of voluntarily, for that he has no control, and you don't say that because he exposed himself to certain areas, certain temptations by day, therefore he has these kind of dreams at night, but certainly the ability to imagine and to dream in a different sense, that certainly is there, and over that presumably there is some measure of control. What are the things that a person gives thought to? This has to do with the latter part of this paragraph as well. as I said, before, four, there are five elements. And the last one she lists in the first chapter is a person's intellectual capacity, the ability to discriminate, to classify, to think, to define, to analyze, etc., etc. We've got to that. The Rambam says that there's some uncertainty as to whether the concept of merit and mishmat, or obedience and disobedience, is relevant to it. He says why there is some disagreement about this, some confusion. He personally is of the opinion that this is indeed possible, because we're commanded to accept certain beliefs and abjure to accept the other beliefs, and this is something which is done intellectually. Now, this is not necessarily to suggest that there may be areas of one's thought which are indeed involuntary, the person has no control over, and if he wants to reason in any particular way, he can't multiply at will. He has to multiply according to certain rules or certain principles. Nonetheless, you wouldn't say, since you multiply per force, therefore you think everything else per force as well. See, what the Rambam says that with regard to the intellectual part of the person's being, the fact that there are certain areas which are clearly halakhically defined and determined, that indicates something about the whole category. Why not move the other way and say that the fact that certain things are involuntarily done by the power of imagination does not mean that the whole category is involuntary? So we've got this heavy difficulty. The question that Rambam raises over here about whether we're going to speak of mitzvahs and non-mitzvahs in the area of the intellectual area. This is something which the Rambam here doesn't explain to why he feels some doubt. And elsewhere, he does raise his manifestos with some degree of certainty. In the beginning of the ninth Sherish and Sefer Mitzvahs, Rambam has the beginning of Sefer Mitzvahs, 14 principles he sets forth, which govern the way that he counted and enumerated mitzvahs. So the Rambam speaks of four different categories. Classifies the totality of human activity, that which is different subject to mitzvahs and avodas. Dash called Sivuya Torah Zorotah, Hinehim, Hinehim, Barba Dvarim. B'deot, B'fu'ulot, B'midot, B'dibur. V'zeh Shuit Sivanu Lahami Yichud Hashem V'avat HaKev V'yirato, Ush Yizran Me'ami Da'at Acher Me'adeot, כמו מה שהזהירנו מהאדנות לזולתו וכציוון, so this is one category which has two days, וכציוון בפעולה מן הפעולות כמו שציוון להכיר בכוונות ובנות המקדש, והזהירן מפעולות ופעולות כמו שהזהירן מהכירים לזולתו יתברך ומשתחרר לנדבת זולתו. Second category of actions, אחרי ציוון להתנהג במידה בין המידות, כמו שמציוון לחמלה ורחמנות והצדקה והחסד, כמו נפתח כמוך, והזהירן למידיעה מן המידות, כמו שמזהירן מהשנאה ומהנקימה לתיראה דרישת אדם מזולת זה, ומביא לזה של הבאר, these are character traits. And the fourth one, which has to do with verbalization, which at a strike line, I think, the Rambam includes, not as the Rabbeinu Bechai, in the Zagdomet HaSavavis, but includes tefillah, אמר שכה ושאל העבורים ורצו לומר לו מה המאמר מן המאמרים כמו שמצוונו לשפחו ולהתפלל להודות על ההבנות ועל הפשעים ודומה לזמן שהתבהר והזהירנו שזה נפס על וסי והזהירנו מדיבור איך המן הדיבור כמו שציוונו והזהירנו מישובה השקר והרחילות ולשורה והכלל הזולת So he has these four categories. The very text of the Rapashut, that the area of Emunis Vidayas, that there can be Mitzvah Sinisur. Rabbi lumps together two things which others might have differentiated. He gives the examples of Dayas as being areas of normative activity. He says, "Sivanu la'amin yichud Hashem, avat akel v'yirato." Those he lumps together. At a certain point of view, of course, those are very different sivuyim. La'amin yichud Hashem, one would take that as acceptance of dogmatic truth, dogmatic faith. That is an intellectual area. Avat akel v'yirato is an emotional response, a yearning, a seeking, a certain cognitive attitude, and people who have some difficulty with regard to the mitzvah l'hamin, they have the same difficulty with the mitzvah l'ahava. They might, but they need not. It is here, of course, an important question which is raised in various planes, but not to which the word of Allah has very clearly determined position, but one which broader circles to purify and question. Many people feel that you can have mitzvahs which regard a person's outer life, his activity, what he does, what he doesn't do, and the assumption of belief and free will altogether, that one can be commanded to do and be restrained, inhibited from doing, although they understand. They have much more a problem with that, the inner life, which they feel is beyond a person's control. And these arguments are raised at two levels. One has to do with feelings, and the best known formulation of that, of course, is the Benezes question, the Resachmer, how can you tell a person not to desire? Sees a beautiful woman, he's filled with sexual passion, he sees a fancy palace, he's filled with other kind of passion. Now, therefore, can be mitzvah with regard to that. Secondly, more so the intellectual area, even people who are not determinists with regard to activity and action do accept the notion of free will, they say, but if a person is not convinced on the basis of rational arguments, or even more so is convinced to the contrary, how can you command him and order him that you should believe? Master Shem, of course, questions whether mitzvahs which relate to belief is an open question. The Rambam and the Ramban of the Bahag will discuss it. The Bahag didn't count the mitzvah of Amun as a mitzvah. But in all likelihood, the reason for that is not that which the modern skeptics give, namely that you cannot command a person what to believe, but as the Ramban notes, the Ramban says that a mitzvah has to be something which is within a system. When it's recognition of the authority of the system, then you can give orders within that context. But whether to accept the system altogether, that is not something which the system itself can mandate. You can only tell you what to do once you're within its orbit. And then it says the Ramban, the Bahag didn't count Emun al Benshem as a mitzvah, because that is not a mitzvah, that is the foundation of all mitzvahs, infrastructure upon which the whole system rests. It can't be part of the system as such. That, I think, is much more like the interpretation of the Bahag than the possible assumption which some moderns would prefer, that the Bahag had the kind of reservations which 19th century liberals had. Question as to whether in the purely intellectual area one could speak of a mitzvah, a chiyuv, an obligation, an Ram clearly does. Here, Pastor Meshul, of course, he opens Mishnah with this. Is one which assumes, people reject and assumes, as said, there's a determinism with regard to argument, and the element of will doesn't apply. And mitzvahs have to do with will rather than intellect as such. The assumption that there is a mitzvah presumably has to rest on one or two bases. One, that mitzvah of emunah, to acknowledge that the basic element of emunah as such, whether the person believes or doesn't believe, this is the Ben Shalom to say, that is indeed not something which he has any control. If he's convinced, he's convinced. If he's not convinced, he's not convinced. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean that there's no room for some kind of normative statement within that context. In purely intellectual, purely rational terms, one could be said to believe or not to believe involuntarily. But that's the extent to which, for him indeed, the concern with this question, theistic issue, is a purely intellectual one. It does not follow that inherently and imminently that is indeed the case. One might say, well, to believe that cannot be commanded, but what can be commanded is what a person does with the belief once he's accommodates and accepts it. The extent to which he tries to intensify it, to deepen it, to sharpen it, to read that which will support it and to avoid reading that which will undermine it, to move from belief as a purely cognitive experience to belief as an emotive experience, or, in terms which Kovach preferred, the friendship of belief and faith. All that's going to be done within the mitzvah of emunah. Of course, one could go beyond that as well and assume that a person is not quite as rational an animal as certain traditions like to assume, and that indeed volition has a place even with regard to what a person believes or doesn't believe. It's famous essay, William James, How the Will to Believe. This thesis is pushed, and James argues in effect is that a person not only can but in actuality actually does to some extent incline to believe that which he wants to believe, and that the ability to convince oneself in accordance with attaining a goal that one wants to attain, not only through the external manner elements of what he reads, what he doesn't read, the rest of Sur, which the Rambam speaks of, but inherently within the form of intellectual discussion per se, he can find himself bending in favor of certain arguments and opposed to other arguments. This doesn't go as far as the position which the early Christian father Tertullian push, namely that a person believes because something is absurd, and the more absurd it is, the more it is subject to belief. But it does assume that the possibility of some influence being exerted by will and volition upon one's intellectual stance in certain areas. It couldn't be reasonable to believe that 2 times 2 is 6. Certain areas that certainly can be done. Ibn Ezra has a similar position with regard to Lesachmeid. And in fact, what he says is that you can bring yourself to a point where you present to yourself something that's being so remote that you can't even imagine to want it. It's not within reach. Your passionate desire for Lesachmeid, particularly as we saw Lesachmeid, is not simply fact, the person longs for something, but tries to move in the direction of its acquisition. Over that, a person does have control. Control of the actions, not taking initiate steps to acquire it, but control also, especially in terms of like the Rambam that Isaac made, is simply this is the passion. Control of the passion, if you distance yourself from it, as the mashal that he gives, a simple country bumpkin doesn't imagine he's going to marry the king's daughter. So the poem which the Rambam here leaves somewhat up in the air. He says what he's inclined to assume, but then to a degree of certainty. So there is some confusion with regard to it, but he comes down on the side that it is possible to hear, likewise speak of Mitzvah of Surin with regard to the Mitzvah Deus. He goes on to say, however, that you cannot speak here of a Mesa Mitzvah, a Mesa Aveda, and therefore, speaking of actions and activities, he therefore didn't include the intellectual part, spoke only of Chelek HaMargish, Chelek HaMitokeh. Here I am in a bit of a loss, this is what the Rambam intends. To a master, which of course is a translation, Halacha has very clear definitions, and it appears that the Rambam is wrong in many, many contexts. But there, and most of you, certainly the Rambam's view, you speak not simply of something which is focused. That is a myself. You speak of something which has a physical sort of expression. Just to give an example, except thinking with regard to the Rambam, others shouldn't disagree. But everybody must. Yesh Maisei Maisei. Rambam says, if you purchase chametz on Pesach, or if you bake on Pesach, and a machmitz, chametz, that's Yesh Maisei, that is Malkus. If you just hold on to the chametz which you purchased before Pesach, that's Yesh Maisei. In either case, there is a very specific act, specific state, which is a violation of the rule of the Ben Shleil. In that sense, whether you are sitting in a chair doing nothing, passive or actively moving about, is irrelevant in terms of defining the Maisa Veirat, which is the Maisa Veirat in the sense that it is the focus of violation of the will of the Ben Shleilim, whether done passively or actively. We speak of emunah, a person believes or doesn't believe. Here it's not just that whether it's you're doing something actively or passively. There's no specific initiative on your part, either passive or active. It's a state. Instead of belief or instead of disbelief. So if you question a person, say, that's a particular mice. Or in certain areas, but whether a person believes in Avodah Zarah, the affirmation, is more formed by Avodah Zarah than Mishnah Sanhedrin. But if we went and dealing with an active affirmation, with the state that this is what his commitment, to what he's committed, that is Eimah Maisa, and something very different from Eimah Maisa with regard to Malkus. Likewise, another area is Manan Malach Veire. Hafshach Kamoicha. And that has a can of practical implications for practical modifications, what you do. But fundamentally, it is first and foremost a state of mind or a state of heart, as is the inverse. So I presume that here, Ram says there's no maise, should I confuse this with a sense in which the term maise appears in the halachic context, but view it in a different sense altogether. There is considerable importance in the portion of Amavixu over here, although it's presented in descriptive psychological terms, but I think there's some latent implications which have to do with how one understands the word of Eretz Hashem generally. Rambam says we're here is the whole concept of accepting, rejecting halachic norm that is limited to certain parts of the soul, the parts which initiate or which respond, the part which feels and the part which stirs. And all of Eretz and Mitzvahs have to do with this. Other aspects of a person's life are beyond the normative pale. Now, this gives a very active and externally oriented cast, character, the world of Avedis Hashem, which could be perceived very, very differently. Ram says that you obey the Ben Shleilam only when you respond, you're initiating. But presumably, one can obey the Ben Shleilam simply by being. One's being is part of the totality of his soul, and that's simply certain aspects which are focused upon doing or not doing. This is what he has to say with regard to the relation of human soul to the halachic discipline. Here he goes on to speak of virtues and the opposite, of course. Virtues which are moral virtues, spiritual virtues, those which are rational intellectual virtues. Rambam speaks to this in the Pirush Rabbis in many places. And it's a focus which, of course, is very much inward, which has to do with the kind of person you are, as opposed to the early part of this section. The early part of this chapter dealt with external actions, focused specific initiatives. He speaks of the ma'alot and qualities of heart and soul. These are qualities which are permanent aspects of one's personality. Then he goes on to speak of different types of intellectual virtues, those have to do with capacity to reason, the discursive capacity to argue from one point to the other, to see cause and sequence, etc. And then, of course, there's the capacity for knowing a certain reality in the first place. First, confront something, you see it, you relate to it, know it in that sense, and then you see its relation to other things, how it's part of a certain causal nexus. That speaks also of the certain qualities of intellectual dexterity, sharpness, quickness, all of these. The intellectual, the moral virtues, here he speaks of a whole range of care, of generosity, of justice, of tolerance, of humility, courage, of fidelity, etc. Now here, and this has been noted by some, whereas in the earlier part of this chapter he had spoken of two parts of the human soul of which he had singled out the first chapter, and he had spoken of the capacity to imagine and to feel, and to initiate. Here in the second half of this chapter, he speaks only of one, the will and the ability to initiate, as far as the moral virtues are concerned. And passive response, feeling, this is only kind of ancillary capacity, auxiliary capacity, which assists the person initiating and doing. This raises some questions as to why the imbalance did we have over here. Shilat, in his commentary on this particular chapter, he assumes that in the second half of this chapter, the Rambam is talking about the educational endeavor. As much to a great extent, this is what he has in mind. If you speak Yavis as an educational venture, and therefore in the intellectual, in the educational sphere, the ability to respond is not so critical. What's critical is the education of the will, and that which moves a person to have certain initiatives. I don't see that the Rambam is explicit here. While also he talks about Klibus Pirushinovich, he says this is part of the educational endeavor. I don't see that it's so much focused, emphasized over here. I think the difference is that the Rambam is talking over there about specific actions, and the second half is talking about not what you do, but what and whom you are. Now, that's not necessarily part of the educational endeavor. What he perhaps is saying is, you're educated to be a certain kind of person, and that's you're educated to be an educated, just educated to do and not to do. So maybe there's some relation to what he's saying, what I'm assuming, what he's assuming. But I think that if you try to mold a person, or to speak of what kind of person one ought to be, even when that's speaking by molding, molding is an action, an active educational goal. Simply where you want to, what you want to get, what you try to describe, I think that this is where the difference lies. And to this end, that which molds a person is the chedek amitoel of Vado. The ability to respond is very, very secondary. Overall, what you have in this chapter, of course, this is critical for understanding the Rambam generally, is the interface and the intersection of the halachic order on the one hand, with all its demands, and more general considerations on the other. The midot of which the Rambam speaks, a midot which are valuable. For the Rambam, I think are valuable not simply as a means to an end. But Zohar speaks of Zehirus and its importance. And this becomes the first phase in Zehirus, the ladder, Zehirus, etc. See, it becomes a quality, regardless of quality, which leads up to the next stage, and so on and so forth, instrumentally. Qualities that Rambam speaks over here, anove, gvure, fidelity, etc. These are qualities that she would admire in their own right. To some extent, means that he's dealing with qualities which are important to him, not necessarily in terms of the halachic mandate, or the halachic expression, but important in what we would describe as moral terms, ethical terms, etc. To be a person who has patience as opposed to impatience, who is loyal as opposed to someone who betrays. Even if you look up the Shulchan Aruch from beginning to end, you find nowhere it starts to betray a person. Even if that should be the case, certainly we've got someone who does it as a scoundrel. all the qualities you listed over here, qualities of Shnei Rama, are very important. Both the intellectual virtues, if you remember that intellectual perfection is one aspect of the perfection of the human soul, of the human being, the moral element, the intellectual element, and all that is part of what a person ought to be. Without direct and immediate impact and input with respect to the halachic area. That the Rambam sultan surprised us. Both in Chasdeis, which begins in what I guess that we would describe as a quasi-halachic world. That begins there with what kind of personality you want to have. And then he takes the idea, which we'll see discussed more much very fully in Shemini Perkim, of the golden mean, so to speak, and after describing it, this is what a good person is going to be like, then he attaches, as it were, to a mitzvah. This is what a person should be. These are, assumes, the qualities, characteristics, kavyochav, and shleilam, and v'lachta v'drachav. This is what he is, this is what we should be. Of course, it doesn't say anywhere in Chazal or in Sukkim, this is the way shleilam is. Can't you look at the Sukkim, you might come away with ideas that the shleilam is not the kind of balanced, that's not the kind of balanced world that Rambam built by you. And the bulk of the first several parakim has said mostly try to latch on to the Damis Midrachov, ascribing, starting with what presumably the description of what the ideal personality is like, and saying, well, that's obviously what Rosh Hashanah is, and therefore this is part of Midrach to Midrachov. Then the first couple of parakim, it's not Achinon there at all. Later on, he goes on. The middle part of Yuchasdeis to speak of things which have to do with physical well-being, totally unrelated. The last two parakim, then he moves on to certain halachic norms, which part of Yuchasdeis. But it's clear that the bulk of the Yuchasdeis is devoted to more general considerations, devoted to other kinds of perfections and ideals. I was very explicit about this, and I've done this on other occasions. Because Tshuva Al Toma, for example, Chagim Moshe, in Tshuva, Al Bavroj, Yesh Ben Maaseh, אלא כשם צריך אדם לשוב באלו, כך צריך לחפש בדעות רעות שיש לו, לשוב מן הכעס, מן האיבה, מן הקנאה, מן העיתוי רדיפת ההון, והכבוד ורדיפת המחור היוצא בהן, וכל צריך לחזור בתשובה. אדם סתם בקונטרסט יש במעשה ואין במעשה. But if again, this is not the contrast of Hilchis, of Hilchis Sanhedrin, where there is Marcus of Don Malchus. What's contrasting is qualities, character traits, anger, enmity, envy, levity, etc. As opposed to specific halachic violations, which have a certain address. And all of this is almost part of the process of tshuva. It's important to stress this because you have those who reject this position, who reject it in two formulations. Either to say that these other things that I'm talks, if they're not part of the world of halacha, can't find a particular address for them, which is a category, so they're meaningless. We are bound by halacha and halacha alone, nothing else matters, nothing else has value. The notion that you speak of ethical categories makes significant, that's a foreign import, this is not Yadus, this is Maskilish, We don't want no part of that. Or, alternatively, to do what the Bala Musa tried to do. They certainly thought that all of these qualities, character traits, etc., are very significant and meaningful. But then they went and they looked to try to find Buddha Shemanoch, which these are to be found. The notion that the things which are valuable Shalan Shemanoch, that they too reject for another reason. So the Rambam says that Shemanoch is extremely important. The other thing which is also important, even if you're not directly within Shemanoch. Others would say either these are not important, the non-Shulchanoch therefore not important, or say no, they are important, but obviously since what's important is the Shulchanoch, there must be somewhere in Shulchanoch, and we have to only find under what subsumed under what the are. The third pelican.
These things are important, but they're not part of the world of halacha necessarily. Does the Rambam learn them out from Svara? Does he learn them out from Parshas and Torah? How does he know what is considered important from the perspective of the Torah and what's not?
I'm still just driving here, but I don't think that the two points we should mention that before we later. Let's assume for the moment that there is some kind of address that you'll find. To a very great extent, what you will subsume under a certain category will depend on what your moral and ethicalness is to begin with. Right? So even if you assume, well, there is some category, but you may look for Mekredis, and if you deal with Kaas, you'll have a Mokka. That, in the Gemara, the Rambam quotes that. Deal with Eva, you have a halachic marker, this is the Chibbut Vavecha. Although for the Rambam, certainly, even if you assume, as some do, that this is only a bit of Vavecha, but if you give verbal expression to this no Issa, the Rambam say that's also wrong. But some of the qualities in which he speaks, the Difata Mamon, that is something which Mishnah describes in Mishnah Navis to be Sameach B'chelko is a proper quality. But then that only takes one step further back. So from where did Chazal derive it? From their ethical instincts? Or did they have some market? Ultimately, you're driven back to the question which is to whether one can give some kind of validity and attach some kind of value to things which are not expressly explicitly formulated in halacha. To my way of thinking, and I've written on this, I think that it depends on what you mean by formulated in halacha. If you want to know if there's called the Shchanoch, there are many things which I think that which are valuable which don't appear. If you ask, well, do we have some general categories, like Yashava Tov, so we'll say everything which is unethical, is it various Yashava Tov, fine. But then what you include in Yashava Tov will depend to a great extent on what your ethical instincts are, what your ethical intuitions are. Although for us, of course, we can find Mikhail, because of Lushen, because of Chazal, maybe even because of Sukim. The acknowledgement of the recognition of the existence of such a category, I think, is the critical issue. Third parak is that in which the Rambam goes furthest in pursuing an analogy which very much appealed to him. And one which I think we find less attractive than he did. It's the analogy between two areas of interest in the Rambam, of course, being a doctor, the world of medicine was close to his heart, and it provided for him a ready store of analogies and directives. The other end, of course, the world of the spirit, in the broader sense of the term, which the central component, of course, was the term of the world of halacha, with which the other adjacent components as well. The analogy between those two is something which is close to him. It was a sickness of the soul, as there was a sickness of the body, and it's been treated as such. The Mishnah Torah, first half of the second parak of Hosea, is focused around this. And it begins with people whose body is out of kilter. Chole haguf, t'amim ma'amar matok u'matok u'mar. Yesh min ha'cholim mi shemitaveh v'ta'ev v'machalot shenaruin la'achila, v'nefar v'apecham. ושני המאכלות הטובים כמו נפת והבשר הכל לפי רוב החולי כך בידם שהשתם חולו מתאבים ורבים בדעות הרעות ושונים בדרך הטובה מתעצי לכת בה וכבדה להמנים מאוד לפי חול ים חד שהיו אומר באנשים הללו היו אומרים לרע טוב ולטוב רע שמים חושך לו ואו לחושך שמים מר לו בתוק ובתוק למר ועליהם נאמר ועוזבים אחות יושר ולכת בדרכי חושך מהי תקנת חולי הנפשות? So, what is the תקנת of חולי הגוף? Not a doctor. Not a doctor. תראו את זה החכמים של רופאי הנפשות. Literally, to take the two components of psychiatry, פשישי ניאטרוס, פשישי סול in Greek, and ניאטרוס is a doctor. You go to a doctor, the rabbi, the psychiatrist, maybe something equivalent. יכול להיות זכמים שרופא נפשו וירפו כל ים בדעות שמלמדים אותן עד שיחזרו לדרך הטובה ומכירים בדעות הרעות שלהם ואינם מכירים זכמים לרפא אותם עליהם אמר שלמה חכמת ומוסר ווילים בזו פרשם נו זה איזיל דאז גו טו דאקטר דומו בראשו and it was described what should doctor do all of this is anticipated in this perk and more fully elaborated This analogy has certain roots and certain implications. I'm not sure how far the Rambam would have gone along with it. First, the Chole HaGuf very often is not responsible, it's not at fault. Of course, there's certain disease as well to which his taste buds are out of tune, are skewed. It's bitter, he likes what's bitter, he doesn't like what's sweet, and reverse. So he needs to be treated. However he's treated, whether he's treated by some, what Rambam prescribes, or treated by the state-of-the-art pills, it's to a great extent mechanical, mechanistic, beyond the pale of morality, in certain respects, we deal with the physical aspect. In certain respects, the roots are beyond morality, and the treatment is beyond morality. The moment you begin to think in terms of a person who likes immoral things, then you have a problem. But if the analogy is to be an analogy, then you have these people whose souls are ill, and therefore they like to do evil, or they like bad qualities, they like to be angry, they like to be envious. So you have to correct that. And you correct it was the equivalent of some kind of treatment which Rambam describes here. If you push the analogy very far, you are getting a sort of denatured perception of the human soul and its treatment. How people get Choli HaGuf, the Rabbah doesn't discuss it here, but they get it in one of many ways, depending on what the syndrome is. There's over here also, but Nashutem Cholot, how do they become Cholot? Given the enormous place which the Rabbah assigns, the most important place, the Rabbah assigns to free will, every person can be like Moshe, but it can be Yerovam. There's some extended fault. But that's not when I was Choli HaGuf. If you deal with the roots, you can't just deal with the symptoms. This is one problem in terms of the degree of which could be an analogy. The other is that I mentioned previously, the focusing upon specific manifestation, specific symptoms. Choli HaGuf, of course, may also have a disease which affects the totality of the body. But many diseases are not of that kind, and the taste buds may be skewed, because we'll still be able to run 100 meters in 15 seconds. So you have to treat one particular facet. To the extent that you speak of spiritual and moral diseases of the soul in the same vein, then too you can speak symptomatically. But presumably if you deal with matters of the spirit, matters of the soul, somewhat more of a gestalt approach needs to be taken, which is less symptomatic treatment and more of a total treatment. Why they cholot? How do you treat it? Rather than simply getting them to have a particular, giving them some corrective direction for a particular symptom. So the same question arises with regard to a technique which the Rambam is very fond of. One of the techniques that I'm particularly focused on was trying to attain a balance, an ultimate balance, which he admired greatly, by temporary imbalance. So assuming that you need to look at some kind of median position with regard to one quality of heart and soul, the person leans too much to the left, you have to make them all go to the right. Moshul, they like to employ in this connection is one from Aristotle. If you have a stick which is bent in one direction, you have to bend it to the other direction in order to get it to be straight. But of course, the question is to whether the person is like a stick. It's very much an issue. It's an issue, I think, with regard to the medical profession as such, whether you have to have an overkill in the other direction in order to get it right. And certainly so with regard to the human soul, where the imbalance they simply produce not something which corrects the first tendency as it were on a scale, but produces a second negative quality which does not cancel out. It's not as if you subtract one from the other, but you have two disjointed elements in a single personality. So probably with regard to this, I've said to some extent it leaves us questioning where's the moral element in this. The moral element comes up in the Ham, of course, the person doesn't go to the doctor. So he's neglecting himself. But what about the source of the disease to begin with? But then it doesn't relate. It makes, I think, with somewhat more technical a mode of dealing with the condition. You have to ask if you're someone who's fundamentally healthy but has a particular disease, or is generally ill and out of joint. It was very different medically, it was very different, even more different spiritually. The extent to which you want to treat, make tumors symptomatic, the extent to which you employ this technique which the Rambam speaks, of bending the tennis and balance. There's no question that this is very close to the Rambam's heart. This paragraph, the next moves on to another point. And the basic status, which I alluded to previously. We'll look at this next time. For next time, we'll do very well to look at both Perek Dal and Perek Hey, which are interrelated. Maybe this is presented by Dal, presented by Perek Hey as well. And see also the Rambam and Perek Berachos Deis in Mishneh Torah, and the essay of Finish Los Hadin in Perek Berachos Deis. The whole Perek should be learned as well in Kesher what we're doing here. Once we finish those two parakim, the bulk of the Sefer, the part relates human soul, etc., behind us. And then we'll move on to more specific issues, momentous per se, but less psychologically and synchronically oriented.